How's it going, guys? Welcome to another episode of the Oilfield Basics Discover podcast, where we learn something new about our amazing and incredible industry on every single episode. I'm your host, Derek Craig, and with me today is Sebastian Jaya. How's it going, Sebastian?
It's going great.
And we also have a guest actually in our studio, per se, if you actually want to call it that. We got Thomas Archer with us. How are you doing today, Thomas?
Good. Doing well.
Great to have you physically here with us. So you're like you're our first guest that's actually here, per se. So everything awesome. Else we've done remotely. So yeah, we're not going to spend too much time going into anything oilfield basics-wise or news-related. Not much has changed since the last podcast. We got a lot of stuff here to talk about today with Thomas. So we'll go ahead and begin diving right in. So Thomas, can you tell us a little bit about your background and how you got started in the industry, places you've worked, and then we'll go from there.
All right. So I went to Marietta College, petroleum engineering.
Sounds familiar. mixed three of us here.
Graduated 13 years ago. Yeah, 13 years ago. So since then, worked for various operators, mainly in the Appalachian Basin, actually all in the Appalachian Basin. And I guess I kind of wanted to talk about the technology that's improved quite a bit over the last 10 years. The name of our company is X-STEM. We came up with the name X-10. That's 10 years of completions work amongst all of our co-founders. We've each been in approximately 10 years. So X-STEM is the name of our company. But a lot of the improvements that we've seen over the last 10 years, 10 years ago, we were drilling laterals that were 1,500, 2,000 feet. And we thought it was a big deal. And, you know, nowadays they're drilling laterals 10, 15, 20,000 feet. Like it's no big deal. Along with, how many stages are being completed. When I first started doing this, we were completing, 8 to 10 stages per well. We were,
and those are probably like 300 foot spacing.
Yeah. 300 foot spacing. I can't remember exactly how much sand we were putting away per stage, but it was way less than what we were, we're doing 500,000, 600,000, 700,000 pounds. Now back then we were doing maybe 100, 150, 200,000 pounds.
Wow. Come a long way on that.
And oh yeah, for sure. A lot of the technology, it's kind of crazy how it's evolved so quickly over the last 10 years. And I foresee quite a bit of it, improving even more over the next 10 mm-hmm. years.
So. And you were mentioning the sand delivery, but how's the water been too? Because I know like now pretty much everything's piped into location here in Appalachia
for the most part. So, back when I started working up in north central Pennsylvania, pretty close to the New York state line. And the truck traffic back 2009, 2010, it was just incredible. And, as you work in it, you become, you start noticing how big of an issue it is for neighbors, mm-hmm. for, just just road traffic, trying to get in and out of a lot of towns that where operations are going on. You have a lot of truck traffic. Nowadays, most waters, you have above ground storage tanks on locations. Mm-hmm. You pipe all the water in or majority of it. And you try and limit truck traffic to as much as possible. So mm-hmm.
that definitely takes a lot of trucks off the road. And these are all primarily temporary lines too, that we're putting in and typically running to a river or a creek or something.
Yeah.
The river around here.
Typically running from a river, which I mean, obviously that's, that's the most efficient way to move the water just because you have so much water there that you're mm-hmm. able to move. Piping water into location, definitely. And it's also a safety issue. Less truck traffic means less chances of somebody getting ran over or backed into.
All kinds of things.
All kinds of good stuff.
Yeah, better all the way around. And it's crazy how long those temporary water pipelines can be too. I mean, they're miles and miles and miles up over all the hills. And
it can take months and months to put in a lot of the temporary lines. And mm-hmm. I know some states, they have permitting issues with putting in those lines. So they got to be way ahead of the game to put those lines in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. But you can use that basically for a whole field.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, you run one big line to all your wells. And then from there, you can run keep moving them around to whatever pad you're on now, one you're stimulating. So very cool. And so you've seen a lot of equipment changes too, and process changes, right, in the way that you've actually gone at, like, toe prep, for example.
Absolutely. So toe prep, you know, back 10 years ago, typically you were perforating your first stage via coil or a stick pipe, tubing conveyed perforations is what it's called, TCP. Anyhow, nowadays you don't have to bring in, you can, with a sliding sleeve, what that is basically, it's a sleeve that shifts open that's at the toe of your well. You basically rig a couple frac pumps up, pressure up on the well, and you can slide that sleeve open, which will allow you to frac, you know, your first stage. So it limits, obviously there's a cost with that sleeve, but it limits, you know, you don't have to bring coil in anymore, limits, mm-hmm. you know, issues that coil could have going in anytime it goes into the well, even though that well hasn't been perforated yet, there's still a mm-hmm. chance you could run into issues.
Yeah. We'll talk about some of the cool tubing operational issues and stuff later on that you can get into, especially from a consultant's perspective, things that can go wrong. But just like anything else in the oil field.
Yeah, sure.
But for somebody who isn't too familiar with what we were just talking about, before drilling and before you actually begin fracking, you have to basically establish communication with the formation. So typically in Appalachia, your entire wellbore is cemented in terms of your lateral. Your lateral is entirely cemented off from the formation. So you've got to have a way of basically getting your perf guns down there treating your first stage or whatever be the case. So typically in the past, you mentioned TCP. So it stands for tubing conveyed
perforations.
Okay. Yeah. And so that was typically done, ran in on coil tubing.
Yeah. Right? So to TCP a well, you would just put your guns, stick your guns on the end of the coil.
And these guns were triggered by?
So ball activated. Okay. You would run your guns down to the bottom of the well. You'd drop the ball, pump the ball down. The ball would seat on top of the guns and, you know,
trigger.
Yeah, trigger. Basically, you'd pressure up and that would activate. I guess the pressure is what would activate the guns. So then they'd be on a time delay. Every, you know, you can set them for different times, but typically every like 6 minutes they would, one gun would go off, and then you'd move up to the next one.
Okay. And was that typically ran with like a bit on the end too? So you kind of got like a clean out run with it or?
No.
Okay. So. Don't know where I got that from then. Yeah. Okay. So that's kind of how it used to be. And that, you know, whenever we had shorter laterals and coil tubing was a norm, then that was okay. But then now that, you know, we don't have to wait on coil to come in and TCP the well and physically run coil tubing under the well. We have what you mentioned, sliding sleeves, which are typically either pressure delayed or they are pressure.
They're based off of pressure. Okay. So sleeves, you know, they're a lot of different people call them different things. I just call them sliding sleeves, but they're based off of pressure. And a lot of companies, they try and, do your case. You gotta do a casing pressure test before you start fracking. You try and incorporate that with your sleeve. So you do your pressure test and these sleeves are, a lot of them now, at least the ones I've been working with, they're based on pressure and time. So once you hit a certain pressure, then that sleeve will shift open or slide open in 15, 20 minutes. So you basically reach that pressure, hope your pressure test holds. Once you hit that pressure, you sit and wait for 20 minutes. I've seen a lot of sleeves though. Sleeves have also improved dramatically over the last 10 years. When they first came out on the market, you know, fit maybe one out of every two, you know, 50% of the time they're going to fail. They're not going to open. You're going to have to go run down in and actually perforate or TCP, I guess I should say. But I've seen some that have opened early. And in that case, you would have to run in, set a composite. Like a cast iron, a bridge plug above your sleeve to get a good pressure test on your casing.
Okay.
So you kind of lose that part of that lateral.
You would lose that 100 foot or 100, however long that section is.
And with the pressure test, you're doing that to ensure like stability and
your casing.
So you don't have any parted casing or a bad cement job or anything of that nature, right?
That's correct. Okay. Yep.
Okay. And the siding sleeves too, in case anybody's unfamiliar with that, that's just ran on your casing string in the toe portion of the lateral.
That's right? Correct. Yeah.
And they literally just shift open. And so now you've got exposure formation. So yep. It's basically as if you went in and perforated, but you know, we can't mm-hmm. pump the guns down unless we have somewhere for the water to go.
Yeah. That's correct.
So that's one of the reasons that sliding sleeves have their uses. But aside from that, is there any other method you've seen in terms of initially establishing communication?
Well, there's, I guess, so there's TCP, obviously the sleeves, and then you can also do sand notching, where you run in, basically use a brace of sand to put holes into the casing.
Okay, so, I've never heard of that before.
It's pretty old school.
Yeah.
But it's been done.
So okay.
It was common, you know, 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how common it is anymore, but.
Okay.
Basically sandblasting the casing now.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. Another method I've seen used is what's called wet shoes. So they just over displace their cement, so they've got exposure to the formation at the end of their casing.
So that's another option you can have, where you have a wet shoe, allows you to still have injection into the well, and you're able to pump your guns down that way. Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah, that doesn't seem to be as common on Appalachia, though.
Nah, it's not as common there.
Still trying to figure out why. But okay, it's not as common up here. Another thing we had wrote down here. So you mentioned, you know, some of the evolutions and stuff you've seen, and one of the ongoing debates, at least in my mind and with people I talk to that are on the completion side and work frack, is always the zipper manifold. Yeah. So I guess we can start off, you know, explain to, you know, our listeners and stuff, in case you're not familiar with what it is, what a zipper manifold is and what purpose it serves on site. Then we can go into the debate, because everybody has a different opinion on whether they like it and want to use one or don't want to use one. And I still don't understand why there's, you know, why aren't we consolidated on that?
Yeah. So zipper manifold, basically use it for your zipper frac ops. And basically it allows you to perform ops on two separate wells at the same time. So while you're running wireline on one well, you can be fracking on the well next to it. Once you're done with that stage, you can swap over the well you're wirelining and just keep swapping back and forth. The manifold, there's quite a few valves on it. I mean, it's not too complex or anything, but a lot of guys prefer, rather than using the zipper manifold, just to do what they would call an iron swap, where they just swap iron from one well to the next. And just after every stage, you'd have to swap to the next well, and just keep swapping iron back and forth. It's a little bit more work for the guys, but a lot of crews, a lot of crews prefer iron swaps over the manifold. Some of the issues you can run in with the zipper manifolds, the valves that are, you know, there's hydraulic HCR valves, which are stands for high closing ratio valves. They are used on these manifolds, and a lot of big frac valves are used on them as well. But you can have issues where they leak. If one of those leaks, you have to get a crew out to tighten it up, and you might have a few hours of downtime. There's pros and cons to everything. Me personally, I prefer to do iron swaps. Zipper manifolds, they're pretty bulky. They're big. Obviously, you're renting them. It's another cost added. Mm-hmm. And they take up a lot of room on the pad. So
is there something that particularly makes them more susceptible to getting leaks? Because in my mind, you know, they're practically kind of like a mirror image of the frac stack almost.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, well, why don't we have a bunch of leaks on the frac stack, you know, instead of,
well, I don't know if there's, so through the manifolds, you know, going into the manifold, a lot of iron, if it's just the sand that's causing a lot of the leaks, which I suspect it would be, but the more valves that sand has to go through, the more opportunities there are for leaks.
Yeah, the more friction.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And one thing else I need personally cleared up for me, whenever you're swinging iron, so I've always been on sites where some form of a manifold was used or something was being used to switch the, you know, how they were pumping into each well. But aside from swing iron. So when you swing iron, is that literally from the top of the goat head to the other top of the goat, you know, or are you swinging it at the bottom?
So for iron swaps, you would be doing it at the bottom.
Okay, so every frac stack will have a set of pipes coming from the goat head to the ground,
yep.
And you switch it at the ground level.
That's correct.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure on that, because I've seen pictures where people were talking about swing iron, but like they all have iron coming out of the goat head on every single wellhead. So I'm like, it must be at the ground level.
Yep,
and that sure makes more
is.
Sense that we don't have to be up on a lift to swap it. But for some reason, I need to clarify that in my head. Okay. Glad we got that covered.
Yeah. Yeah. And so also with kind of the sand, as you mentioned before, like the amount of sand that operators have been using lately has been, you know, exponential compared to a couple of years ago. I guess they've seen increased production rates and keeping that formation propped open. Before, like, you know, 5-10 years ago, you'd see the giant sand castles on location and sand everywhere. But that's definitely not the case today. You have a lot more control and you have these box systems, correct?
Yeah. Yep. So there's a few different operators. As a matter of fact, I think, I shouldn't say operators, service providers that are in this business of transporting sand, Sandbox being one of them, Aeros Up is another one, PropX, there's all different kinds of them. Basically, it's a box with sand in it that they're transporting down the road to the well sites. But no, these boxes, they've helped dramatically in terms of getting accurate more precise mm-hmm. measurements on your sand, how much sand you're trucking in to the pads. They know how much. Typically, most boxes are going to hold 40 to 42,000 pounds of sand.
Compared to a semi.
Compared to a bulk trucks. See, you never really know how much they're going to be hauling.
Yeah.
So with these sand boxes, once you fill it up to a certain line, they know that.
Yeah.
They know that there's 40,000 or 42,000 mm-hmm. pounds. Roughly, you know,
yeah.
mm-hmm. but compared to bulk trucks, it's way more efficient, way more accurate. And, you know, on location, it's helpful to all the guys that are out there because there's not as much silica dust blowing around,
yeah.
which,
yeah.
you know, that's one of the big hazards if you're working in the sand area on a frac location.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty easy. If you're not wearing a mask, you can breathe that silica in and develop silicosis and would not be good. So
mm-hmm. that's one thing that even just in the 4 years I've been here and been on tours and been on well sites and stuff for companies I work for, that's something that companies are continually standing mm-hmm. against per se, and they're doing actions to remediate that. Like the dust suppression.
Yeah. So I believe, don't quote me on it, but I believe it's OSHA's mandating that you have to have those on frac sites.
Okay.
So, mm-hmm. and it may be state to state, but I've talked to several different frac vendors that have said the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, and my understanding, like with the big benefit of suppressing the dust, or how the biggest way it's done is just removing the act of blowing it off the trucks, right? Pretty
yeah.
much.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So literally, like the boxes, you put them up on a conveyor belt
yeah.
kind of underneath it, and
yeah.
basically dump it out
yep.
under the conveyor belt. So.
Yeah.
Okay, so that helps all over, yeah. you know, with the dust control. So
yeah, yeah, for sure.
That, good thing there. And then with the obviously now you're just physically picking a box off of a truck and literally loading it onto, you know, on site ready, you know, waiting until it gets to sit on the what do you call it, like the offloader, where you put on a conveyor belt.
Kind yeah, of deal, conveyor or, belt. Yeah.
Okay.
So
and so that helps with getting it on and off location sooner, like the,
yeah.
the actual trucks themselves and. Can move
lowers your costs for
mm-hmm.
sure.
Yeah,
more efficient. And
it's more yeah, and I think there can still be demurrage costs involved with that. You know, if they're sitting around, but yeah, it's another one of those deals with there's pros and cons to it. But I think the pros, a zipper manifold. Some people think they're good. Some people
mm-hmm.
think you know it's 50-50. But
mm-hmm.
prop and delivery, I think there's definitely more pros than cons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, gotcha.
In terms of using, you know, wanting to use the sandboxes.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Yeah, so kind of moving off that topic, and another one that we had written down here to discuss was kind of just a little bit of the migration to greaseless wireline. And not everybody's doing it, but some companies are starting to kind of migrate to that type of technology. And so I guess kind of explain how it's typically done, traditionally done.
Okay.
So pack off and, you know, compared to now with greaseless.
So traditionally you'd have just normal wire line would not, you know, you'd run through whenever you're entering the well, you'd be going through your lubricator, and at the top of your lubricator would be your pack off, which is where you have your seals and your grease is pumped into. With greaseless, you don't have any grease that you're running. So there's less friction, which means less tension on your tools.
Which means you can go deeper,
which means you should,
longer laterals.
Yeah, it should be able to go deeper, longer laterals, it's less wear and tear on your line. So your line should last longer as well. But also less mess on locations. A lot of times when you you lose your seal on your lubricator, you know, grease starts flying around location a little bit, and you try and get that seal back as quickly as possible. Here, you don't have to worry about that because it's greaseless. You don't have grease flying around everywhere.
I'm sure the frac hands appreciate that.
Yeah, sure, and everybody that has vehicles out on out on location, so.
Yeah, so just to clarify that for anybody who's not familiar with the wireline side of the industry, whenever you're running literally like a physical wireline into the well, and so the lubricator helps to, you know, it sits on top of the wellhead, holds the tools, and then your pack off is basically what isolates the pressure from wellbore pressure where your tools are at to atmospheric where your wireline is being held at and entered into the well. So
the lubricator allows, I should have clarified that. The lubricator allows your wireline tools to enter the well under pressure. So,
Okay. And so the grease, to me, this is fascinating how it's worked. When someone showed me this on location, it's literally just, there's not too much room besides, you know, the pack off and the wireline itself going into the lubricator, but you're literally injecting grease and then removing it a little bit further down. Right. And it just, that forms like a hydraulic seal around it.
Yeah, the seal around the,
that's pretty crazy. And how fast they can run in and out of the wells.
It's amazing. Yeah.
And how it contains thousands of pressure, you know, PSI pressure, which is crazy.
Another thing we had wrote down was,
going through another side of the completion side is, you know, back in the day when we were completing these wells, typically we would run cast iron frac plugs to isolate the different stages. But today we've been seeing more of composite plugs to help the drill out, you know, the drill out speeds at the end. Can you kind of go through that evolution or that change?
And what the primary differences too. Are.
Okay. So yeah, nowadays I haven't seen any cast iron plugs ran long time for fracs, but all operators, all service companies, or I guess I should say plug companies, have composite frac plugs. Mm-hmm. They allow for better running speeds. You can run faster than you can with a cast iron. There's no metal parts. If there are, very little metal parts on most of the composite plugs, which means you don't have any metal parts being left behind in the well, which can say, you know, if you're flowing the well back, obviously saves you from beating up any surface equipment or facilities. And then obviously you have faster mill times with composite bridge plugs compared to cast iron. I shouldn't say bridge, frac plugs. most mill times are, you know, 10 to 15 minutes is pretty average nowadays. Gotcha. And a lot of it could be due to the improvement of mills or motor and mills over the last 10 years, but a lot of it's to do with the improvement of plugs.
And do you have any experience with, kind of big topic now, hot topics, dissolvable frac plugs? Do you have any experience with those?
I haven't used any dissolvable frac plugs. I've used a lot of dissolvable balls. But in terms of frac plugs, I think that's going to be something we see more and more of over the next couple of years as, you know, they start, developing those plugs better and lowering the cost of those plugs. And as operators start drilling, you know, longer and longer laterals, you're going to see a lot of people going to those dissolvable frac plugs where, you know, there might be the first few stages of those wells might, you know, it's going to be hard for even stick pipe to get to.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that's going to be something the next couple of years it's developed quite a bit more.
Yeah, so I think operators going to, for the longer lateral lengths, they'll use dissolvable plugs for the first few stages at the toe of the well, just because it's hard for wireline or even stick pipe or coiled tubing to get all the way down, you know, to set the next stages.
And
one of the limitations that we see with the dissolvables is the salinity requirement, but especially the temperature requirement.
Yeah.
So I think that's one of the reasons that it hasn't made as big of a market in Appalachia compared to maybe some of the Texas basins that might be a little hotter, or Haynesville or something like that. So I think at least in Appalachia, we don't see it as much. But I know that it's in other basins, you know, it has a little bit more of a, you know, it's being used a little bit more often.
I think you're
a little bit bigger success.
I haven't seen, I know a few operators are under them around here, but I haven't seen any. Like you were saying, I mean, higher salinity, you know, higher temperatures, going to be easier to dissolve. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. So one of the things that you just mentioned, I want to clarify, you mentioned that you have seen dissolvable plugs or dissolvable balls being used. So what's the particular benefit to running on a dissolvable ball?
So, dissolvable balls, typically they'd be used on your first, you know, your first 5, 6, 7, 8, 10, however many you want to do, I guess. But on your first 8 to 10 stages usually is when you'd want to use them. So your first 3 or 4 or 5 stages fracking, you're pretty cautious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're trying to prevent screen outs.
Mm-hmm.
So you're dropping these dissolvable balls where usually they dissolve in, I don't know, roughly 24 hours. A lot of it's dependent on the salinity of the water and pressure. But you'd have to wait, I guess. You'd have to wait a little bit before you would be able to, because you got to wait for the ball to dissolve.
Mm-hmm.
So typically, say you do have a screen out and you dropped a dissolvable ball.
Mm-hmm.
Usually you move on to the next well, start fracking it. Try and give that ball time to dissolve. You can initiate flow back, but the whole point of dropping that dissolvable ball is so you don't have to flow the well back on those first few stages, where you can just let it dissolve and then try and reestablish injection into the previous formation once that ball, or previous stage once that ball dissolves.
For those that don't know, like with the completion process, once you set your plug and then you perforate, you'll pull out your wireline tools. And then you'll drop a ball, and then you'll monitor the ball, you know, being dropped, and then it'll see into that frac plug. And then as you're monitoring kind of your pressure graphs in the data van, then you'll see kind of a quick little spike there, which indicates that the ball was seated. And then you could make it establish rate for that stage. And so that gets repeated stage per stage.
So that kind of ties in, you know, technology even on that's improved quite a bit. You're saying, you know, after you, you know, shoot your guns and pull wireline out of the hole, drop your ball. A lot of operators are starting to go to ball in place, where your ball is basically already, it's just sitting right on top of your plug, and you don't have to drop the ball after you pull the wireline out. What that does, it allows you to you're saving water because you're not having to pump the ball down.
Mm-hmm.
You're saving time because whenever you are pumping that ball down, you want to do it at a real low rate because you don't want to slam the ball into your plug and basically pressure it out.
Yeah.
Wouldn't be a good day. But nowadays, you know, a lot of operators are going to that ball in place where you can basically seat the ball right as soon as you start pumping, break the formation down, and then you can start your stage right away.
Gotcha.
You don't have to sit around and wait on the ball. And, you know, it might not be much. It's probably, you might be saving 5 to 10 minutes a stage, but over the course of, hundreds of stages, it adds up a lot.
Yeah. And so those are the pros. Now, operationally and running it and stuff, like what would be one of the risks or
cons on that? So one of the risks is, some balls are like inside of a cage, so you wouldn't be able to flow that back.
Oh, wow.
So
it limits you a little bit.
Yeah, it limits you a little bit. You basically have to run in, and if you couldn't flare that back, you'd have to do a clean out run, and you'd have to TCP the well with coil.
Okay. So to save a couple minutes, you didn't have to bring coil in. Yeah. It's a little bit of a harder sell than I imagined. I got a lot more people were doing it, so I guess they like it.
But I've also seen them without without the cage. Mm-hmm. So there, you know, there's pros and cons to it, but I think mm-hmm. That's another one where the pros outweigh the cons.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Okay. And operationally, is there an issue like with setting it any different or any more challenge of setting it or?
No. So the plug and the plug sets the same way. The ball, you know, it's basically the same as well. Okay. The only difference is, you know, you're eliminating, I guess you still have to have a guy go up and take off the lubricator and drop the ball, but you're eliminating the guy, you know, dropping the ball. It's I guess there's not really
don't have to have somebody up there on the man lift to actually do that.
Yeah.
So I guess it kind of goes inside with the rig lock. You'd mentioned that in previous discussions of using the rig lock.
Yeah, so rig lock, it's another improvement that the industry's seen over the last few years. And rig lock, basically what it is, it eliminates a guy having to go up and remove the lubricator from the well or put the lubricator on. So
and that's for wireline.
Yeah, that's for wireline operations. But the amount of time you save with that, basically rig lock, it's a piece of equipment that goes on top of your goat head and it seals and unseals the lubricator being stabbed onto the well. But it eliminates a guy from going up in a man basket and having to do that. And it also saves you time. You're also seeing another, you know, 5 to 10 minutes of time being saved per stage when you're using rig lock.
Yeah, and if you use that with a manifold, nobody would have to ever swap.
I've used rig lock quite a few times, and for one operator specifically, we were using rig lock. We were also using a plug that would allow you to run extremely fast speeds of wire. Or allow you to run your wire line at pretty fast speeds. But when we were using that rig lock, doing zipper frac ops, we were doing, you know, 13 to 14 stages a day in 24 hours of, you know, 500, 550,000 pound stages. Oh, wow. So it was actually a record for that operator in that.
That's pretty impressive. So. Yeah, and for anybody else who wants to learn more about the rig lock, that's actually a video that Sebastian and I have done a video on. So they've come to the school and give presentations, and they support. They gave us some of, you know, their presentation stuff. So we recorded a video on that. So if you want to know how it works and more information about that, that's actually a video blog that we did. So you can check that out on our site. Another topic we wanted to hit on was electric frac fleets. It's kind of hard to say fast. So what's kind of your experience with that, and how's it kind of moving into Appalachia per se?
So I've worked with electric fleet before. Worked for them for a few months or so. I wasn't a big fan. They work great in the Marcellus, where you're treating at lower pressures. However, in the Utica Shale, higher pressures, they see a lot more issues. A lot more issues with just pumps going down. I don't know if the technology is there or not.
Mm-hmm. That'll there continue yet. To continue to evolve.
Yeah, which it's going to continue to evolve, and it might not be there yet for the Utica, but for the Marcellus, lower pressure, it's something that's we had pretty good success with it. But usually, you know, they're used. I guess you'd want to desire, the neighbors would want them to be used in urban settings. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So where you're going to be close to a neighborhood.
Yeah.
You know, that eliminates, if you're using electric frac fleet, they're super quiet. It eliminates, you have to put it up a sound wall around location. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously you're wanting to use it in urban environments. Mm-hmm. But the electric fleet that I've worked with in the past, it was so quiet that I didn't do it, but I've heard guys say that you could actually go up and put your ear on a piece of iron and hear the sand running through it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
So, yeah, which maybe you can do that on regular card, but I've never done
maybe
that
if you
either.
Plug the other area.
yeah, but obviously, you know, you're using a lot less diesel. One requirement is, of course, you'd need field gas. You need natural gas to power these. So you'd want to, you know, you'd want to be using it where you do have gas being piped in or a pipeline that's, you know, coming to that pad. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah, we had, what company was it that came in?
U.S. Well Services.
Okay, yeah. So we had
Clean Fleet.
Yeah, so they came to campus here, Marietta College, yeah. And had a little discussion on that. Something that I think we're going to try to get him on the podcast to talk about too at some point. Mm-hmm. That's pretty cool what they're trying to do there. But one of the cool things about what they're doing with the electric frac fleets is that they're cutting out the lower kind of bass rumble, you know, the rumble you can feel in your chest. And he was saying that's actually what travels. And that's what drives the neighbors crazy.
Yeah.
That's what
travels through the ground.
The vibration.
Yeah.
Miles away. And stuff.
Yeah. So that's pretty cool what they're trying to do there. And it'll be nice to see how that plays out and how who all ends up doing that over the next couple of years.
Yeah.
And so you mentioned like treating pressures. Can you kind of give us a few numbers on common treating pressures for the Marcellus versus the Utica?
A lot of it's, you know, it's usually rate dependent, but typically, you know, the Utica is going to be, you know, 2,000 to 3,000 mm-hmm. pounds higher than the Marcellus. So
okay.
Marcellus, you might be at 6,000 to 9,000 PSI. Utica, mm-hmm. you might be, you know, 10,000 to 12,000.
Gotcha. Yeah, it's a lot deeper and a lot high pressure.
Yeah.
So another thing we wanted to hit on, because you guys have a lot of completions experience, you know, as consultants, obviously, is some of the issues that you guys can run into on everyday operations. And that's one of the things that I'd like to hit even more on as we have more guests and maybe even you come back on a future episode, actually kind of take one or two of those instances and dive relatively deep on them. Say, okay, well, this is how we got here. This is like almost step by step in a sense, like walk us through it. But I mean, for what we have left, I mean, we'll be a little bit high picture, but you know, still do whatever detail you want to go. But I mean, what's some of the operations? Let's just continue with frac, and then we can go into more of drill out kind of coil or stick pipe operations. So on the frac side, you know, what's some of the things as a consultant that you're looking for, you know, that you're watching for that don't go wrong?
Okay. So during a frac, obviously, you want to make sure your treating pressure isn't real erratic or spiking up real high or anything like that. But you know, there are instances where you can have what they call a screen out, where you're, mm-hmm. you know, you're unable to inject any more into the formation because you've pressured out. Mm-hmm. So in that instance, basically you're not able to pump any more sand into the formation. You got a bunch of sand in the wellbore and you have sand falling vertically down mm-hmm. into the curve of the wellbore. So what you'd want to do, you need to initiate flowback procedures as soon as possible. And basically what you do is you'd have a iron tied from the flow cross, or, you know, some people tie it off different places. You can do it on the goat head, but you'd flow back to a what they call a flow back tank or a gas buster. And you'd try and get all the sand and all the, all the sand out of the well, what they call your slug of sand. Mm-hmm. Once the well cleans up, you don't have any more sand coming back, then you should be able to reestablish injection. A lot of consultants, they like to get the ball back from that stage. That way, you know, you're pumping into the next formation mm-hmm. and you know that, you know, when the ball reseats, if you didn't get the ball back, that you wouldn't be pressuring out again. Mm-hmm. So
mm-hmm. now, typical success on a flow back per se, or, you know, I mean, like, 'cause I know, like, if that doesn't work, you're bringing in some type
of, you're bringing in coil to clean out or rig. But, no, I mean, the first few stages are typically you want to be the most cautious because you really don't have any reservoir pressure yet built up. After 5, 6, 7 stages, you know, you have a little bit of reservoir pressure behind it mm-hmm. and it assists you in flowing the well back. First few stages, if you screen out, you don't have much pressure to help lift the sand up out of the well.
Those would also be the harder ones to get in with coil tubing.
They'd also be hard, that kind of ties into using dissolvable balls. But anyhow, so that's one of the issues that you know, the first few stages are always kind of stressful, that you're always just, mm-hmm. you're always watching everything place, but you know, those stages, you do not want to screen out. So,
and do you see people running more conservative designs kind of towards the toe?
A lot of operators, you're going to be a little bit more conservative in the mm-hmm. toe than you would be, you know, uphole.
Yeah. Okay. So never really thought that. I never thought that the toe of the well would be treated different than that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense now. Thanks for clearing that up.
And so kind of going back to like types of prop that we've discussed, have you heard of like micro mesh, and do you have any experience working with it, or?
No, I don't. I've heard of it and my partner Logan, he knows a little bit more about it than I do, but I'm not sure if he's used it either.
Gotcha.
If you guys want to talk about it or delve on it.
Maybe that's something we just need to have on the podcast, talk over with all the...
So is that MicroMesh? Is that the name of...
I'm not sure if it's like
the brand or
a company's, you know, mesh, but I've heard that, you know, you have like 100 mesh typically run in these wells. This is like 500 mesh.
So
it's designed to get into like the micro fractures of the reservoir and keep that open to hopefully boost production. I haven't, you know, been around it or heard of any operators running it, but
I've heard of it, like I said, and I know one vendor that's trying to sell it right now. And I supposedly, based on results from an operator that I don't know if it's an operator they've sold it to or not, but the results were pretty good, so it's definitely something that may be used in the future. Used more.
So besides screen out then, you know, in terms of operational issues, what else are you looking for?
You're saying during the fracs. Basically monitoring pressure, sand concentration, your chemicals, you know, this is my experience is all slick water fracking, obviously you can get into crosslink and a bunch of other types of frac, but, monitoring pressure, flow rate, what your rate is, how much you're pumping, total barrels pumped. Obviously, like I said, sand concentrations, your chemicals being a friction reducer, biocide, scale inhibitor. Just making sure that all those, you know, you want to, the most important chemical that I, you know, in terms of slick waters, FR, if you lose your FR, then you're not going to be able to frack, your pressure is going to spike and you'll have a screen out.
Yeah. So friction reducer.
Yeah. Friction reducer, I guess I should. if you want to keep a good eye on, like I said, the FR, if you lose that even for a minute or two, it can really wreak havoc and have some major issues.
So another thing you wrote down here was stuck wire line. I'm kind of wondering too, like even equipment, you know, downtime and stuff, how frequently you're seeing that kind of happen, or what would be the major causes of either one of those?
So there can be, you know, there can be several, I guess, several different issues can go on with stuck wire line. You could have a plug that preset, which means, like, you know, it's set, but you're still on the plug. so that can be an issue. If that happens to you, you'd basically have to set the plug wherever it's stuck. And you'd have to bring in coil to drill it out.
If it's not close enough to where you want it, right?
Yeah. Another issue with wire line would be sand. Say you didn't flush the well good enough. You still have sand in the lateral or in the heel. Your wire line could run into sand. You could get stuck there. It's happened to me many, many times before. You have to go over to your flow back manifold, open up the manifold, flow it back a little bit, kind of move the sand a little bit to kind of get unstuck from that. It's kind of a lot of the stuff's things that you just learn over the years how to do. Nobody's really taught you. You just kind of go out in the field and you learn it.
Way through it.
Yeah. Although, you know, technology's improved a lot. A lot of the stuff still the same.
And in terms of like equipment, you know, on site, you know, what's anything commonly break down more than other things, or
typically
spare pumps
for pumps, a lot of seats and valves, so companies, you need to make sure when you're out on location that companies are doing the proper maintenance. Mm-hmm. You know, every stage they're going through two or three of their 15 to 20 pumps that they have on location, going through changing all the seats and valves, greasing everything, making sure all their equipment's good to go prior mm-hmm. to the next stage. Mm-hmm. So when you don't do that is when you have
whenever you have issues rise.
Yeah, yep. Yeah. If you don't keep up your maintenance, you're going to have major issues, and they'll probably be bringing in another vendor to provide the service.
Yeah. And so you want to transition a little bit to coil and talk about, so now, you know, now that the frac's been put away, you know, frac's done and left location, so you're going to bring it in and drill out the plugs that are in the wall. So.
Yep. So after the frac's done, bring in coil. Like we were saying earlier, you know, as laterals get longer, more and more companies are going to be going to snubbing units, bringing in rig assist or standalone mm-hmm. snubbing units. Those are starting to become pretty popular with the longer laterals. But, you know, typically in the past, coil units have been the way to go on shorter laterals. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of issues that you can run into with coil. A lot of people, that's another reason why people are going to rigs and standalone units. Coil, a lot of some of the issues that you can run into, you can get coil stuck pretty easily. You can part pipe, you can get pinholes in the coil. Whereas on a rig, you have a lot more ability to pull. Typically with coil units, you're going to max out a lot less than you would max out on a rig. Mm-hmm. Coil pipes, obviously, a lot, not as strong.
Durable.
Yeah, not as durable as a pipe on a rig, you know, mm-hmm. stick pipe.
I think, I mean, that just goes back to the nature of coil tubing itself. It's one long, continuous pipe. Yeah, right. So yeah. If you get a hole in it in one place, you got to what replace the hole?
You're gonna
reel, I guess.
Yep, so. Sure. So, you know, the coil companies have programs that show how much life, you know, the string of coil has, mm-hmm. and at a certain percentage, they're supposed to remove that out of service. Yeah, it's more likely, and
if you have an issue,
they're mm-hmm. supposed to remove the coil out of service and
okay,
put on a new reel.
And just by nature, it getting stuck easier is a little bit of a function of both not being able to push and pull as hard, but also especially not being able to rotate it.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. That's
the biggest thing probably.
Yeah. Okay. So and that's another, you know, huge, pro of using stick pipe. You know, you're able to rotate. You're able mm-hmm. to
swivel. It's like a mini rig basically. Yeah. Yeah. And so maybe somebody who by chance you're not familiar with coil tubing, because I always wonder, you know, how on earth do they rotate it? Well, they don't. So, they don't actually rotate it. They have a motor at the bottom of it that is ran off of pumping your mud through it that actually turns the bit. So that's how that works. So in case you weren't familiar with it, like I was a couple years ago. So, yeah. So anything else in particular on the coil side or even so let's say you do stick pipe, you know, there's something. Any kind of operational issues or challenges?
You know, there's, I guess, a lot of the challenges, typically, a lot of them come in the winter due to, you know, temperatures. So mm-hmm. keeping equipment running, keeping heaters on equipment, keeping them tarped up, glycol lines wrapped around equipment. Mm. Usually in the winter is when you'd see a lot of those issues with freezing up, pumps going down, pumps mm-hmm. freezing up, pumps mm-hmm. getting ice in them.
Do you have issues with like ASTs, like the water storage on site freezing?
Yeah,
we wrap the lines and blow the lines, but what about the big tank?
Yeah, so they try and keep that water circulating where you don't freeze up, but that's definitely an issue that you can run into.
Do they heat it? Like, is it like a big heated swimming pool?
No, I'm sure some operators do. I know some operators you know, take their frac tanks and basically put them in a house, put a tarp over them, put a heater under the tarp.
Gotcha.
So, yeah, the ASTs, that's I'm sure they may do that out west a lot more, but in terms of heat, I mean, so they have oil heater, oil, it's so a big heater that they bring out that the water runs through.
It's like hot oil or
something. Hot oiler,
There we go.
Yeah, hot oiler.
Consultant 2.0 now.
I haven't worked around a hot oiler in a couple few years. They're crazy expensive.
And kind of on the other side, in the summer months, have you seen, you know, above storage tanks, ASTs gone dry or not having enough water on the
location? You know, that's an issue that may, you know, you're probably going to run into that maybe more down south.
Gotcha.
Up here, this area, as you guys know, the past few months, crazy amount of rain.
Yeah.
But really in Appalachia, you don't run into too many droughts or issues where you're, you know, you can run out of water, but it's just because water wasn't pumped to the AST or wasn't trucked to the AST or whatever. Mm-hmm. But no, we don't have many issues with that, but that, that could be an issue down south more where water, you know, droughts are an issue.
Especially in the Permian.
Yeah.
Mm. Can't imagine.
Yeah.
Over 400 rigs down there and imagine how many.
Yeah, I don't know where you guys get all your water.
Yeah. It's crazy down there.
Anything in particular with parted pipe that you want to speak to, or
you know, parted pipe?
Is that speaking to the stick pipe drill out operations? I assume.
Well, I've never seen it happen on stick pipe before. I'm sure it can, but coil tubing it happens. I've seen parted pipe happen a few times. So basically, you just have to go down there and fish it out. Mm-hmm. So you'd want to bring in a rig for that.
Yeah. Okay, so whenever. Let's say coil gets stuck, you know, as a consultant with some of your methods that you're seeing. Because honestly, like, probably, I don't know, the times that I've been on coil, it's been, most of them have been stuck. So.
Yeah.
And part of that just, you know, my experience as an intern, you know, whenever the bad things are going on, the problems, you know, that's when we get sent to location, check it out, right? So that's part of it. So it's not that happens every day. But, you know, what's some of the go-to methods, I guess, for
you want to work. Whenever you are stuck, you want to work your pipe up and down, see what your weights are. You know, you don't want to overpull to cause your pipe to part. But some of the methods are, you know, maybe building up pressure on the backside of your coil at your flowback manifold, and then opening up your manifold. That kind of that surge, what they call surge in the well. That surge may allow you to get some movement downhole. In the past, I've surged wells where that's how I've been able to get free. You know, close your backside manifold, continue pumping, let build up a little bit of pressure, then open it up, and it allows, you know, stuff to move downhole, or at least you're hoping it does. another option would be to you know, rig up nitrogen on the backside of your coil. Pump down on the backside of it, try to energize it a little bit. You try and avoid doing anything like that where you're energizing an already energized well. But you know, when you get into situations like that, you kind of got to weigh your options and see what the best one is.
What benefit would nitrogen have over just pumping on it?
It'd be energized. So nitrogen would allow you to, the fluid to lift up and then, you know, lift up off the horizontal. But it's one of those deals where it may work, it may not. You don't know until you try it.
And you said you pump that in the backside or down the
So coil? You'd pump, I guess, the backside of the coil.
Okay.
So you'd rig up, you know, nitrogen pump on the backside, pump down it. Obviously, you'd want to watch your pressure. You don't want to be, you know, having pressure spike on you or anything like that. I think I may have done that once or twice in the past. It's something that you don't want to get into. You don't want to have to do, but it's an option. Most of the times when I've had coils stuck, you know, build up a little bit of pressure at the manifold, just keep pumping on. The biggest issue is you don't want to lose your circulation. You know, if you lose circulation and you're stuck, then it's a whole nother ball game. That's when you'd probably want to bring in nitrogen if you do lose circulation.
And at what point do you cut it? Per se? that's happened before, isn't it?
So, you know, operators are typically going to give you, you know, they'll work with you, but I mean, 6, 7, 8 days, you start adding up the time and the money that it's costing to be sitting there. And you kind of just got to weigh your options. What's economic, you know, you cut it, you're going to have to go fish it. So it's a game you don't want to get into, but at a point you get frustrated enough and you're starting to burn money. starting to waste time. And
is there a disconnect downhole? Because I know like a wireline will typically have a disconnect.
You can disconnect
off the head of it. But.
So they at the end of your BHA, you should be running a disconnect where you can – it's just a ball drop. You drop the ball, and you're able to disconnect your motor and mill from your coil.
Okay.
So that would be – before you would cut it, that would be your first option. Drop your ball, disconnect your motor, your BHA from your coil, and start pulling out. You still can't pull, and that's when you'd be getting into – cutting the plate.
All right. So, do you have anything else you want to add, Sebastian, or any further questions?
No, I think I'm good.
All right. Any last minute comments from your time?
Yeah, you can check us out. We got LinkedIn page. We have a website. It's going live soon.
There we go.
XStemConsulting.com and LinkedIn's XStem Consulting. So.
Awesome. Yeah. So we thank you for taking the time out of your day to come down and meet with us even in person. So in our quote unquote studio, I guess, isn't we record these podcasts like a different room every time almost. As opposed to our video blog studio we actually created. But thanks so much for taking the time and talking through some of these things with us and helping us to get this perspective on the industry. So
appreciate it.
Big thanks for that. And then also want to remind our listeners to please leave us a comment, leave us a review on this podcast. So whatever method that you're listening to this, you know, leave us a review on the platform that helps other people find this podcast, people outside of the industry even potentially find this podcast. And please share, you know, our posts and stuff on our social media and follow us and just do what you can so, to help us get the word out there about this podcast, about Oilfield Basics and everything that we got going on over here. So, and of course, you know, if you want to be on the podcast or work with us and help show your little piece of the industry, please reach out to us. And there's also a get involved tab on our website that you can check out as well. So looking forward to more and more collaborations and things to come in the future. So thanks again for following us, and we'll catch you in the next one.